Are you stuck in the present? Our culture is quick to dismiss anything perceived to be old, even last year's cell phone model, much less the wisdom learned from history. And those of us raising up the next generation with classical Christian education are more often looking to the past for wisdom in a world that insists the present is all that matters. My guest today will inspire you to gain a new appreciation of history and learn practical ways to better navigate the daily bombardment of information from modern-day forward-only thinkers. We welcome back to Basecamp Live, David Moore. Stay tuned for this episode.
Mountains, we all face them as we seek to influence the next generation. Get equipped to conquer the challenges, summit the peak, and shape exceptionally thoughtful, compassionate, and flourishing human beings. We call it Ancient Future Education for Raising the Next Generation. Welcome to Basecamp Live. Now your host, Davies Owens.
Welcome to Basecamp Live. Davies Owens on the line with David Moore. David is back. It's been since 2018 you were on Basecamp Live. David, so good to have you back.
Thanks, Davies. Great to be back.
For those who don't know you, you cover a lot of ground in terms of your writing and your interviewing yourself. Regular contributor to Christianity Today, Jesus Creed, Gospel Coalition, Huffington Post. You've had three previous books. We're talking about your newest one here in just a moment. You hosted a one-hour PBS special where you interviewed William F. Buckley. I personally think that's one of the most fantastic interviews I've ever heard with Buckley, and I know we could get off on this whole thing about that interview, but you really brought him to life, his personal side of his life. Excellent interview. Commend that to folks. You've got one of the highest-ranked radio shows in Austin, where you live, for your time slot, and you've interviewed over 200...
Past tense.
Okay.
Past tense in that. Yeah, thank you, though.
Yeah. Okay.
Everything else is true, but past tense.
Okay. You did at one point. But you have interviewed, and it's probably more than 200 now, well-known scholars and writers, including three Pulitzer Prize winners. Any rate, prolific writer in your newest book that I'm holding in my hands is called Stuck in the Present, subtitle How History Frees and Forms Christians. So David, first question, love the title. What does it mean, Stuck in the Present?
Well, you know, the title originally was, the main title was Making Connections, Linking Responsibly to the Past. And I use that title. These are, I've been teaching on this stuff for probably 20, 25 years. Probably about 10, 15 years ago, I put together my own little makeshift notebook that had that title somewhere around, 8, 10, 12 years ago, Making Connections, Linking Responsibly to the Past. And as is typical, when you use a title over and over and over again, you kind of get used to it and attached to it. And then when the book finally was accepted by the publisher, he said, I love the book, love what you're doing. There's two things I'm going to request of you. First one is I want you to expand your teaching. So I had like 25,000 words. He wanted it more like 40 to 45. It's now like, I think, 45,000 words. So still relatively short. We wanted a kind of an intro primer, but yeah, wanted to cover the waterfront. The other thing, as he said, which was a good suggestion too. I was happy to add the extra material. But the other one, as he said, your title is fine, but not punchy enough. It's tepid. You know, we need something that just kind of gets a little more arresting of people's attention. So, I probably groused a bit for a few hours after that phone call and thinking, okay, here we go. Here's heavy-handed editor, I'm going to have to, defer and everything. But the more I thought about it, I thought, he's really right. I need to come up with something. So that really fits the spirit and the urgency, frankly, of the book. Making Connections was not really fitting the urgency of it. So for some reason, I got literally stuck on the word stuck. And I thought, wow, stuck. I need to have stuck somewhere in there. So I came, the study's upstairs. And so I came downstairs and my wife was in the kitchen. I said, hey, they want me to change the title, which I think is now a good idea. And I like the word stuck in the title, but I don't know what stuck's not enough. It's generic. And so my wife said, well, How about Stuck in the Present? I said,
there you go.
Bingo.
Leave it up to our wives to come up with a better title. So,
but she's splitting the royalties with me. 50.
Very good.
I want you to know that. And the subtitle I'll say is really significant, how history frees and forms Christians. And so that subtitle really gives the gist of what I'm trying to do in the book.
Yeah.
The problem is the title, We're Stuck in the Present. And what I'm trying to do is show how history frees and forms Christians.
So when you say we're stuck in the present, what does that look like? I mean, the average person today, if you're saying they're stuck in the present, what does that mean? I mean, we're all kind of living in the moment. So what does it mean to be stuck in the present?
Stuck in the present is you're trying to figure out the present moment in our culture, all the crises, all the fracturing that's going on in our culture, all the contending for, you know, what is the American experiment all about? Is the American experiment worth preserving, et cetera? Just, you know, how do I understand immigration as a Christian? All these issues that are pressing in on us. And Davies, the majority of people, including the majority, sadly, of Christians, are trying to determine and decipher what they should do in the present by only knowing about the present. So the two big feeders of getting information would be social media and cable news or some other, whatever news fits with my echo chamber. So if I'm more conservative and I lean right, I'm going to go to conservative sites that kind of confirm what I already want to be true. There's no being challenged. There's no bigger perspective. So you're trying to understand your present moment by only knowing about the present. And the vantage point is way too shrunken. It has its own assumptions. You know, C.S. Lewis said reading old books is good because, yes, people in other periods made their own mistakes, but they didn't make your own peculiar mistakes. So, you know, a peculiar mistake of the modern era is speed and efficiency. Other errors didn't make that mistake. We could talk a lot more about that. But Stuck in the Present is basically I'm trying to figure out the present moment, all these issues going on by just knowing about things that are coming out right now.
And is part of that uniquely, and I know our audience and you're a big fan of classical Christian education. I know your son, we mentioned at the beginning, your son Chris taught at the Ambrose School with us here in Boise. And in fact, our prior podcast was really on how those of us, as we've passed beyond our school age, can still delve into the world of classical Christian education. So on the one hand, I would think our audience, we ought to be probably, I guess, compared to the general population, pretty interested in the past and interested in the cultural impact of the past. But even so, in general, and I think I completely agree, just the world, the water we swim in here is very dismissive of the past. And maybe is it because sometimes in many cases, our history classes were pretty dry and boring back in the day, and we just don't really see history as having much relevance.
Yes, I think that's a big part of it. I mean, the stereotype and the thing that you hear a lot is, oh, history is about a bunch of dead people and events that are over with, you know, as if there's complete closure, nothing that can teach me. And it's just, you know, why would I want to learn about stuff that has no relevance to me, and all I'm doing is memorizing dates? And so, you know, I think David McCullough and others who've done a great service and really writing great history and writing well, beautifully, have talked about how, you know, probably the number one reason why a lot of people are bored with history is, frankly, a lot of people teaching it that have no business teaching it.
Yeah.
You know, it's the stereotypical, and I'm being stereotyped here, the coach, the PE coach in high school, who's really consumed with sports, but he's got to, for some reason, his contract says he's got to teach a history class, and he didn't like history in his class. He maybe cuts jokes in class, and no one learns much, and it's just, you know, that's the reason why that stereotype works, is because it's prominent. But it's like, okay, yeah, I can kind of relate to that. Okay.
Yeah, I remember the coach I had. As we kind of set this up, there are these challenges that are just deeply embedded in our culture. There's the you know, the poorly taught history class. You also talk in the book about really a kind of an anti-intellectualism that's very pervasive in the modern evangelical churches that many of us are part of. We could talk about that. What is that force impacting this?
Well, it's huge. You know, R.C. Sproul said, the late R.C. Sproul said that several times that in his estimation, the period in which we were living, the modern evangelical post-World War II period, was the most anti-intellectual ever in the church. Whether you agree or disagree with the statement, you know, whether you think that's a little hyperbole, I think there's a lot to that. And there's a lot of, for American culture, there's a lot of feeder streams that affect why we're at that place. And I deal with that in the book, as you know, about kind of sketching the history of the head and the heart. And even the way we conceive and conceptualize of the issue, like what really matters is the heart and the head is not significant. The way we separate, and we can talk about any of these in some depth if you want, the way we separate knowledge and wisdom, which does not stand the scrutiny of the Proverbs, frankly, the way that we've misinterpreted and therefore misapplied a passage like 1 Corinthians 8:1, that knowledge, you know, puffs up and love edifies. We've lost total sight of what that context is about, which is about idolatry. It's not about some kind of intrinsic problem with knowledge per se, but it's talking specifically, if you look at the, you know, a little before in chapter 7 and following, it's all about the warnings against idolatry. It's been totally misinterpreted from a lot of pulpits, a lot of Bible teaching pulpits. And when you look at the context, you go, holy cow, this is not like saying, hey, beware of knowledge, it's dangerous. It's saying, be aware of idolatry and handling your knowledge about the vulnerability that some people have as far as a sensitive conscience toward certain types of meat sacrificed to idols, et cetera. So it's been a massively misunderstood. And even in the same book, as I mentioned in my book, that, you know, Paul talks about in your thinking, be mature, don't be a child. So why would he six chapters later in chapter 14 say, hey, be mature in your thinking, be thoughtful? Why do we look at his life and we see a brilliant, thoughtful, discerning person, Mars Hill, et cetera, and the very same person saying, hey, what you see in me, what you've heard in me, these things do in the grace of God will be on you.
Yeah.
Why would he tell us to emulate that?
Yeah.
So a lot of stuff that, is, you know, we're trying to tune into a radio station. There's a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of a static going on.
Well, and it's a culture, the cultural waters we swim in. So we sometimes don't, you know, don't even recognize how significant that is. And again, some of the irony is many of our kids are in these classical Christian schools where there is an emphasis on thoughtfulness and reading and thinking. And then oftentimes our churches are, not to ding all the churches, but a lot of them, to your point, are very much of the mindset that it's, you know, it's creation, fall, redemption, pray to know Jesus, and that's the end of the story. We don't need to figure out and work out our salvation with fear and trembling in the context of history. But we're going to take a break in just a second, but as we kind of set up what this problem is, I wonder too, you're not only, what I hear you saying is not only have we kind of ignored the importance of history. You quote in here David Borstein, who says, you know, trying to plan for the future without a sense of the past is like trying to plant cut flowers. we're so detached from, and history does repeat itself. Are we also, David, vulnerable to, there's no true, you know, the void will be filled. And it seems like what's happening culturally right now is there's a lot of revisionist history, the critical race theories and the social justice warriors coming in with their narratives. Like there's no neutral ground. So if we don't own and understand history, it will be rewritten for us. Is that fair?
I think it is. And there's a whole chapter dedicated to how to do and understand responsible history. And we can talk about that some. Looks like how to discern the better books, et cetera.
Yeah. And we are going to get super practical here in terms of like, how do we actually do this? And some of the barriers that we've kind of all inherited in terms of, David, I know you're not advocating, find a dusty book and go get excited about it. There's some ways to really make history come alive. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. I do want to get back into, you mentioned the kind of the head and heart tension. I think that's a real challenge. We're going to take a break, come right back, and we'll jump right back in on this great topic.
Hi, This is Brad Leyland, and I'm the CEO of The Focus Group. We're a fundraising consulting firm, and our mission is to help build the kingdom of God by helping nonprofits raise all the funds they need to accomplish their missions. Over the past decade, we've partnered with dozens of classical Christian schools around the country by providing training and capital campaign counsel. We're honored to play a role in the growth of this very important movement. If your school is ready to take its fundraising to the next level, we'd love to talk with you. For more information, please visit us at thefocusgroup.com/classical.
Welcome back to Base Camp. Davies Owens on the line with David Moore talking about his brand new book, Stuck in the Present, How History Frees and Forms Christians. David, there seems to be, we're talking a little bit about just this moment in time we're in, especially in our Christian space, where I think there's a little bit of a, for some, a resistance to things that are seemingly intellectual, how many angels are dancing on heads of pins, and we have more practical things to do, and we just need to go love Jesus. And so there's this kind of, it's often framed as a head-heart tension. So talk a little bit about how you explore that and what discoveries you make in your book.
Well, there's a number of things. One is that a lot of times people will say, object, like maybe pointing to someone like me or you and saying, oh, you guys are, you probably are always good students. You're gifted as teaching. You know, I don't know where to begin. You've had all this background. You kind of know how to navigate all these things. I'm overwhelmed, and I just don't feel like this is that pertinent or important to me. What's interesting about the scriptures, and we could look at both Psalm 1 and Proverbs 1 as examples. Psalm 1 says that it's not the brightest person, it's not the most gifted person at teaching, who is supposed to meditate on the Word of God night and day. That the idea of perpetually soaking in the scriptures is a function of what person do I want to be? Okay. And then in Proverbs 1, I asked an Old Testament scholar, Drew Johnson, who teaches at King's College, about this, that I'd been studying Proverbs for many, many years, and you always hear the thing about knowledge is what you cognitively apprehend or understand, and wisdom is what you do with what you understand. And so people would jokingly say, I've got a grandmother who dropped out of school in the third grade, and she's wiser than a lot of guys that have three PhDs, because wisdom's where it's at, not knowledge. So the problem is, yes, obviously, empirically, we can find, you know, women and men who dropped out of school for whatever reason and live a more circumspect, or we'd say a wiser life than a lot of people with all kinds of formal learning. But that doesn't really answer the question as far as how important knowledge is vis-a-vis wisdom. In the Proverbs, and Drew really helped me even further clarify this, I've been studying for years, and I said to my goat, man, it sure seems like the dynamic interplay between knowledge and wisdom is a lot tighter than this two-step idea that I keep hearing about in evangelical churches. And I said, the illustration I gave to him was, it almost seems like he got a coin that on one side obverse is knowledge, on the other side is wisdom. And if you split a coin in two, it doesn't have as much value. And he said, yeah, the Proverbs talk about increasing in knowledge, increasing in wisdom. And the illustration which I give, which I think drives us home, is Norm Abram's, you know, This Old House show on PBS. Some people might remember that show. I don't know if it's still on, but, he cognitively understands a lot about working with lumber and wood and how to design and all kinds of stuff. Now, that doesn't automatically mean guarantee that he's going to make wise decisions, but it gives him the capability to make wiser decisions. And so the same way, I think we intuitively understand this, you know, we go to a mechanic, if we have more knowledge of how, say, the radiator works or whatever part of the car, the transmission or something works, then our ability to be able to discern and make a wise decision on whether the mechanics, you know, telling me the straight scoop or taking me, no pun intended, for a ride and saying, oh, you need this, you need that. It doesn't ensure that I'm going to use that knowledge, but it gives me the capacity to be wiser. So the Bible is very pro-knowledge, and just like it's pro-wisdom. And the idea of that you could be wise in the best sense by having a shrunken amount of knowledge is not a category that Scripture entertains just the opposite.
Well, and I think it's a good word of encouragement, because I know, especially again in our classical Christian worlds, or again, the brutal truth is a lot of us as parents feel quite intimidated even by our own children, especially around about fifth grade when they're out reading and out thinking and out logic, using logic in ways that are intimidating, quite honestly. And you talk in the book about the difference in having intelligence and being intellectual. So I think that's a good talk a little bit about that distinction, because it fits into
well,
this point.
Well, I use it. As far as I know, it started with Jacques Barzin, a longtime scholar, writer at Columbia. And then Frank Gebelein, who some of your listeners may recognize that name, longtime educator at Stony Brook. And so I got it from Gebelein. He got it from Barzin. Basically, it's the idea that intelligence, like we think, like as Christians, like I'll ask periodically, and I can't ask anyone that's listening today because now they know the jig is up. But I love asking people who don't know me very well, say, hey, do you ever go to church, or do you go to church to be intellectually stimulated? And people look at me like, that is the weirdest question I've ever had in my life about church. Do I go to church to be intellectually stimulated? No, I go to worship God. Is usually the answer.
Right,
it's like,
right.
Oh, like worshiping God is not like mind expanding, mind enlarging. So Barzin talked about intelligence is your native IQ, we'd say. You know, it's what you've been given by nature, by if you're not a Christian, or given by God, in the case for a lot of us that are, you know, part of this podcast. So God gives us, and you know, there's some debate about whether your native intelligence can be increased. I think there's evidence. Harvard's done some stuff. One educator there that you know, used to be thinking that it was set in cement, and there are some things that seems like within certain boundaries that intelligence can be increased or decreased. Mm. Notwithstanding that, so intelligence would be my native aptitude. Intellectual is how much do I want to think based on what God has given me. So, for example, I know people that have probably more of an average IQ, and they think really, really well. Conversely, and I mentioned this in the book, I've known people that have, I'm sure, deep into a genius IQ, 140, 150, 160 even, and they're lazy, they're bored, they're distracted. So it's possible to be very intelligent and not an intellectual. And it's possible to be, I think it's desirable, I should say, to be an intellectual, meaning I'm going to use all the brains God has given me, just like I'm going to use my resources financially God's given me. I'm going to use the energy God's given me. I'm going to use the connections for good, the networking that I have with people that maybe can help other people out that don't have those connections. I'm going to use all this battery of resources to help others.
Yeah.
And so that idea, I think, you know, intellectual is a really boogeyman word, because it's viewed as a person who doesn't, you know, this person would never go to the hospital and sit with someone and who is dying. They're just totally in their head, all that sort of thing. I used to have, when I was a pastor, I had a sign that said intellectual activist here. And I wanted people to see that the head and the heart should be wed together.
Yeah.
And Paul zealous? I think if you ask the question, was Paul zealous? Everyone's going to go, oh my goodness, he was really zealous. Well, was he a stupid, like unengaged thinker? It's like, no, he was brilliant. It's like, oh, well, that's Paul. Paul's weird.
Right.
You know? But Paul says, hey, what you've seen in me, these things do. So anyway, there's a lot more.
Yeah, there's a lot to say there. And again, we're going to come up on a break in a second. Before we do, kind of one more related question. And I think about, you know, the kind of the two sides of the road, the proverbial ditches to fall into. Again, given this particular audience, I think you've probably got more people hopefully listening. They're going, yes, David, I agree. We need more of that. We're kind of in a dumbed down society. The other ditch you fall into, again, is becoming hyper-intellectualized, or even, you know, especially in the classical Christian circles where folks almost pride themselves on how unnecessarily verbose and complicated and over-intellectual they need to be. So what is, obviously that's the other danger, I guess, is going the other way.
I would say there's nothing like ministry outside your circle of comfort that will change that. For me, my story, just really briefly, was I was not a good student in high school, got into an enormous amount of trouble, went off to college not knowing what I was going to do, and kind of floundering a bit, making okay grades, but not really that engaged. Became a Christian and immediately was, probably prematurely, but immediately thrust into situations sharing the gospel with people in cults and a bunch of other things, defending the Christian faith. And I remember early on thinking, if I'm going to continue to do ministry in these sort of ways, I need to learn a whole lot more. So I hear you, and I think you can look at those kind of people you just described, which give learning a bad name. And you will see people that are in very protective environments. They're kind of in their own world, and they've got their own little coterie of people that maybe listen to them, but they're not really doing anything scary. I've taken some of those people that are really, really smart like that and taken them into settings where they have to share their gospel. And it's like, they're trusting God in some fresh ways that they need to be doing. And so I think there's nothing like ministry outside your circle of comfort to make you more seeing the dynamic of that, not being that bad intellectual.
Right. So. Yeah. Coming down from the ivory tower a bit wouldn't hurt, and getting out and serving. Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, speaking of kind of being practical, David, I really want to just get some, hopefully folks are saying, yes, I need more of that. The whole time you're talking, I'm thinking about Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death. We live in this soundbite world. It sure is more tempting to watch the next Netflix thing than to dust off the book. And like, how do we really, help us kind of jumpstart this, the thoughtful life, the historically grounded life. I really want your practical wisdom on that. Let's take a break. We'll come right back with David Moore. He's worked with families for more than 30 years as a licensed professional counselor and marriage family therapist. It's time for a quick encouragement on the best practices of raising the next generation. We call it a McCurdy moment. Keith, it's hard to look at the news on any given day and not see something about depression rates or suicide, especially in that teenage young adult world. It is epidemic. Something's gone wrong. I'm sure that's a huge issue you're dealing with in your office. What is going on, and what should we do about it?
You know, teenagers come in all the time with elevated levels of stress, anxiety, and depression. And I'll give you one thing I use to look at. You know, the level of technology addiction and what that does, and just how much stress and anxiety is driven by social media, is huge among teenagers. And so one of the things I do is this. I challenge them to give me 1 month. And if they really want to tackle this, give 1 month to see how much this is affecting them. And they go dark. And if they agree, going dark means they lose all technology. All technology. Now, the one thing I will allow them to use, because again, they're teenagers, is they can use their phone, but they shut off all functions except phone calls. And if they agree, parents get involved, they shut down or they shut off all their accounts, there's no social media, and they go a month. And I challenge them, I said, let's just go a month to see if we can touch this in this meaningful way. So here's what happens. I'll think of a guy, I'll call him Joe, and he was just a funny teenager, 17-year-old I worked with. And so he agreed. He did the challenge. He came in after week one, and he was crazy. He said, oh, my gosh, I can't believe you're making me do this. This is horrible. I'm going crazy. I'm missing everything. I just can't take it. You know, the FOMO, fear of missing out. So we had to process that.
A true withdrawal going on.
So, yeah. Right. So we get to week two, and he comes in my office. He says, I'm going to kill you. And this kid was really funny. He said, if my parents really did not know, I would think about taking you out. I can't believe you're making me do this. This is torture. Third week he comes in, he leans back on the couch, he's quiet for a second. He looks at me and he says, "You're good." And I laugh and I say, "What do you mean?" He said, "I haven't missed out on anything." And he said, "Wait a minute. No, I have. I haven't missed out on anything of value. Mm. Everything I've missed out on has been drama." Mm. Mm-hmm. By week four, he comes in and he says, in every manner that we could evaluate, anxiety and depression had fallen. And he could say, there is no question, I am functioning more calmly, more at peace, less anxious, less stressed out than I was prior. Now, the big issue at that moment is I've never had a student stay dark, nor is that really practical in the world we live in. So the question then is, how do I return and use this as a tool and a resource with a smaller footprint in my life? But it's amazing to me when I strip that out of a teenager's life, within 1 month, they function drastically differently.
Yeah. And once they've tasted and seen there is life on the other side, they're more prone to go back to it. Which is
that is the hope and the goal.
That's
right?
Well, that's great. Well, I'm going to shut off because we were on an electronic thing. And I want to make sure we go dark. Got a question for Keith to answer on a future McCurdy Moment? Well, send it to us at info@basecamplive.com and learn more about Keith McCurdy on the speaking page on the Basecamp Live website. So David, here in this third segment, really want to get practical. We live in soundbite world. How do we move from being trapped in the present? What do we need to do just to get out of the allure of everything present? How do we move into an understanding of history?
Well, I think, again, once we see that we're convinced, okay, there really is value having a longer view, to have more reference points, not just the immediacy of whatever is hitting me, then I think a question that needs to be asked, and it's an important question, is, well, how do I go about this? I'm being literally deluged daily with just so much stuff. And whether it's cable news or social media or conversations with friends, everyone's saying that whatever it is they're talking about, whether it's the change of the voting situation in Georgia, whether it's immigration, whether it's stimulus packages, whatever the issue du jour is, that's like takes on such urgency. So how do I make traction? To be an expert in anything, this is going to take a long time. I'm overwhelmed. I'm just going to hunker down in my little space. I think one of the most practical things is that whether it's the Bible or history or anything, working on a car, learning a car, is getting the big picture down first and then getting more detailed. So what I mean by that is, I'll use this illustration. When I was at Stanford doing college ministry in the 80s, I had a graduate Bible study, and I got my first computer. This was like 86 or something, 87. And it was like, whoa, this is crazy. I can't believe we're in this world. I got my own computer.
With a big green screen. Yeah.
Yeah. It was just weird, you know, and Kent Major, this graduate student at Stanford, he was already a whiz on the computer. And so I brought him over, and he was very patient and gracious and willing to help. And I told him, I said, "Kent, now I know that the keypad on a computer mimics a keypad on a typewriter. They look the same. The letters the same place. I know that, but I don't want you to assume that I know that. I know the difference between hardware and software. I understand that. But I really want you to assume nothing, because I want to build my knowledge from the ground floor up." I think what a lot of Christians make the mistake of, because they're embarrassed, frankly, is admitting how many of the basic things they really don't know. I've asked people to explain, the Orthodox doctrine of the Trinity and a bunch of other things that are kind of basic doctrinal elements or history stuff. And people struggle. I mean, Christians who have been at churches, good teaching churches for a long time. And I think a lot of that is just a pedagogical neglect of saying, hey, build from the ground floor up. So if you're learning church history, start out with a good survey book like the Bruce Shelley book, Church History in Plain Language. Whatever it is historically that you want to learn, don't jump in the deep end first. I mean, get maybe even a great book that's written for junior high students that really gives the flow of ideas from ancient to medieval and on it goes. Get that big picture down. I think that's really, really helpful. And people would make a lot more progress if they started there and then got more specific.
Yeah, I think some of it's just like you are indicating, kind of a fear to start. It's like, I can't eat that entire thing. I can't consume, you know, starting with War and Peace probably isn't the best idea. I mean, like, it just, you need to, you know, baby steps. I mean, and right. And manageable small successes. And honestly, again, so many of us that have kids in classical Christian schools, again, just it's okay to lean over their shoulder a little bit or read a book with them, you know, when it's, you know, eighth grade reading Beowulf. Well, maybe you've never read that before. And, you know, so there's just, it's almost too easy when it's happening under your own roof in that regard. But okay. Yeah. Carry on. Cause I, by the way, you've got some wonderful, we're not going to get to them all, but you've got these maxims for productive learning are part of the book. So just so folks know, this is, you've made these cases for why we need to not be stuck in the present, but you've also given some wonderful suggestions for how to move forward. What might be another one?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, we should ask ourselves, there's a, you know, thing that psychologists and others use, historians use it, called metacognition, which is a fancy way of saying, how aware am I? How much do I think about the way that I think? So meaning that, am I aware that I'm kind of in an echo chamber, that I'm kind of just listening to people that kind of say the same thing that I believe, you know, how aware am I that I'm willing to, you know, put my beliefs kind of out there by reading someone that I know I'm going to maybe disagree with. And I would only say that this is a wise thing to do once you kind of got that big picture down and you've read a little bit more. But I think, you know, on the maxim thing that you mentioned, I think we ought to ask ourselves this question. This kind of gets to, how do I think about the way I think and how is our culture? I think you see a really toxic combination. And again, this is not something the Christians are immune from. Sadly, I know a lot of Christians that are falling prey to this, is that people are more opinionated than ever. But I think you can argue that people are more ignorant than ever. And we just, because of social media, we feel like we're almost emboldened and empowered to speak authoritatively on everything. And frankly, I mean, to become an expert, even just what the Pentateuch teaches on immigration is going to take a while. And so if you're a Christian going, oh, you know, this kind of immigration is wrong and I know it and blah, 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 and you've got maybe some kind of very superficial idea, it's like, no, you probably need to slow down a bit mentally and say, you know, why am I so defensive in saying that? What am I threatened by? You know, I think we need to ask these kind of diagnostic questions of ourselves. We love to ask them of other people, but we got to ask them of ourselves. So I think some of those maxims that you refer to, so I think also I should highlight this, and we've kind of talked about this throughout this interview, that, but I want to say it explicitly. So my book is an encouragement to read history, but then my book also gives a number of strategies or ways to go about it. And so the maxim chapter, the last chapter, is, you know, things like, you know, how well do I really understand this issue? What kind of manner do I treat the issue in? Is the issue a major issue or is it a minor issue? And so there's a bunch of ways to kind of delineate how we navigate tough conversations. And frankly, you know, I know a lot of people who either could not talk about Donald Trump. These are Christians, could not talk about their differences over Donald Trump and or lost significant friendships over that. Christian. So whatever you think about Donald Trump is immaterial to what I'm saying. If that's the case, and we Christians for many years would love to say, oh, Luther says whatever the gospel, you know, wherever it's relevant, if we don't speak to that issue, we've kind of betrayed the gospel. Well, talking about, you know, who's fit for being president and a bunch of other things around that, what does it mean to be president, is a very significant issue. To think that, you know, we can't even talk about that. So I think we need to do a better job of asking ourselves these kind of diagnostic questions.
Yeah, and as you're saying that, David, again, this is, we need a whole nother hour here because this is such an important topic. I again, we're not immune from the cultural moment we're in, and it's not static. It's a moving current that we're wrapped up in. And I think as Christians, we're getting swept into really an increasingly anti-intellectual, hostile. We've moved from kind of a laziness to a hostility, meaning there is, this is a whole nother longer, but to your point, deconstructionism began, 20 years ago in universities or even before, where there's sort of the idea, it doesn't matter what the book says, the facts are relevant. It's whatever it means to you. And we've kind of, now we're in a world where it doesn't matter what truth statements were put out there. It's just whoever's got the loudest voice. There's no, the ability to even have thoughtful social dialogue is increasingly difficult from secular folks. And I think we Christians kind of figure, well, the currency we trade in is whoever can shout the loudest or whoever's the biggest emotional moment. And so all the more reason for what you're saying is, no, stop everyone. We were made in God's image with minds. So therefore, how does that play out in how we interact and engage the world? And I'm rambling here, but I think the point of your book is more urgently needed than ever as the world around us continues to slide into emotionalism and anti-intellectualism. So,
yeah, I would say, and I would say on that, because most of the people, not exclusively, but most of the people I talk to are Christians, I want to say, yes, that's true for sure. The culture is definitely there, but a lot of Christians are committing the same error,
right?
And unwilling to tolerate, having a reasonable conversation. A lot of Christians are just as emotional, just as anti-intellectual as we've talked about. And so I want to say, in our own household of God, we need to do a heck of a lot better. I mean, there's a lot of Christians that have, understandably, and I appreciate this, strong opinions and convictions about, say, critical race theory, and have not read Marx and have not interacted with important sources. And I'm not saying you have to have a PhD in these sort of things, but again, I think our instinct is to feel like, oh, we're an expert because we have the Spirit of God in us and we can just kind of say whatever's on our mind. It's like, no, you can have the Holy Spirit in your life, but you can still be saying really foolish things, And I think a lot of Christians have hurt or witnessed to the watching world because it just looks as reactionary as some of the extreme stuff on the other side.
Yeah.
So,
well, And again, I know time is short. And as you and I were saying before we started, just there's also just honestly fatigue. I mean, people that you've alluded to this throughout. There's just so much amusing ourselves to death. There's so much coming at us. Folks just want to throw their hands up and say, "I'm just going to go out in the garden and forget about it. I can't even participate. It's so overwhelming." And there's good news here. I think you can take those steps, is what I'm hearing you say, as far as re-entrenching. So David, this is, again, a lot more we could say. I cannot encourage folks enough to go pick up a copy of your book. Tell us where we can find it and learn more about what you're doing.
It's available, as they say, everywhere good books are sold. It is a good book.
Well, I mean, it's on Amazon, right?
Yeah. Amazon is the easiest place. Books a Million, Target, Walmart, yeah. All of them have it. But it's Stuck in the Present. I go by my middle name. Probably if you put Stuck in the Present, David Moore, it'd pop up, you'd see it. But I go by George because years ago when I started writing, I noticed that, in fact, my first book, which was an academic book, when it was posted on Amazon, I noticed that I was on the same page as a statistician named David Moore. So he had a bunch of textbooks on statistics. And there's my book on hell and how it's changed over the years in evangelicalism. It's like our books are right there as the same author. So David George Moore, but got Stuck it. In the Present, David Moore will probably get you there.
Sounds great. So, I guess unless you're concerned that statistical books are like being in hell, then maybe that would have worked for you. But I'm glad you differentiated for everyone. So, well,
we've got a son who's an accountant, so I can't say
that. Yeah, that's right. Well, David, it's been a joy to have you back on. We'll try to do it before another 3 or 4 years elapses, and appreciate your voice and the important message you're bringing through this book. So thanks so much, David.
Thanks, Davies.
Hey there, everyone. This is Paul Drake with Basecamp Live and the Society for Classical Learning. Davies and I are excited you tuned in today. We want to hear where you are listening from, so send in a shout out or a question to info@basecamplive.com. And don't forget, share this podcast with someone you think will benefit from it. And until next time, keep on raising the next generation.